Hi, listeners, and welcome to The Looking Glass, the audio complement to the SAIS Review of International Affairs. My name is Jen Roberts, your host for today's episode. This episode is particularly exciting because it combines our previous issue of Who Runs the World, a look at gender and international affairs, with our forthcoming issue of Conflict in the Fifth Domain, which focuses on cybersecurity. So what exactly is gender disinformation? In this episode, we will hear from the two experts who coined the term gender disinformation. We will discuss what gender disinformation is, how disinformation campaigns against women are inherently different than their male counterparts, examine some case studies, reflect on how gender disinformation is amplified with minority groups, and reflect on the role of social media companies in perpetuating gender disinformation and what can be done to counter this problem. Today with us on The Looking Glass, we have the two founders of She Persisted, the initiative that coined the term gender disinformation. Could you please introduce yourself to our guests and give us a little bit of background and tell us what She Persisted does?
I'm Christina Wilfor, and I am an activist for democracy, a specialist in elections and campaigns, and I just happen to get more involved in the field of disinformation and countering disinformation because of its outsized role in undermining democracy and helping authoritarians around the world.
And I'm Lucina Di Meco. I am a women's rights activist, a gender expert, and also a recovering political activist. And I've had the pleasure to work with Christina around gender disinformation for the last few years. Both Christina and I are co-founders of She Persisted, the only global initiative dedicated to tackling gender disinformation against women in politics. The way we do it is through research, supporting women leaders, and advocacy for better digital platform standards.
So what is gender disinformation, and how are disinformation operations conducted against women different from disinformation operations conducted against men?
Disinformation is content that is intentionally false and it's meant to cause harm. It can be motivated by a variety of factors. There's an entire industry to make money off of disinformation. There are bad actors who are trying to have political influence by misleading people and creating dangerous narratives that undermine a healthy democracy. There are foreign or domestic actors who are trying to cause trouble in pushing their agendas. When disinformation is shared, it turns often into misinformation. Misinformation is also false content, but the person who's sharing it doesn't really realize that it's false or misleading. Gendered disinformation is a new phenomenon that we have defined at She Persisted.
We started talking about gender disinformation a couple of years ago, truly as the spread of deceptive or fake, false, inaccurate information and images against women political leaders. It can be against also women journalists, women public figures in general. And we see that the storylines that women are attacked with, the disinformative storylines, truly are steeped in misogyny and in limiting gender stereotypes around the role of women. So the gender dimension is around the fact that it's targeting women and also around the type of narratives that women are targeted with that are really substantially different than the narratives that are targeting male politicians.
Can you describe a case study where this was apparent? Maybe the 2020 primary in the United States? I know you touched on that on your website. Or perhaps an international case study or two.
Yeah, absolutely. So we did a study of the early months of the US Democratic primaries. And what we found was that not only the female candidates were attacked more than the male candidates with very negative narratives, but also that there was a fair amount of coordination and a strong presence of what are often called inauthentic actors. So there was definitely, a strong coordination. And what we saw when it comes to the narratives was that really the narratives around the women in politics were mostly focused around their character, their personality, and were aimed at framing them as weak, as liars. There was a lot of negative content, disinformative content around their sexuality. And there were narratives around them being weak or stupid that were really playing on sexist tropes.
What we can say about this issue is that, and this is part of what makes it so pernicious and nefarious, is that the definition I used before, where disinformation is intentionally false and it's designed to cause harm, has difficulty applying directly to how we look at the situation around attacks on women. It's hard to prove that she didn't sleep her way to the top, or that she's an untrustworthy figure, or that her appearance is worthy of being sexualized. You know, these are all attack lines that are common to women leaders, women candidates, women election, even poll watchers and workers, in the way that their voice and participation is meant to be eliminated from the public space, and using this baseline of sexism and misogyny in order to weaponize those attacks. And so we saw that play out very dramatically in the 2020 election, and we continue to see it. If you look at the way that members of Congress in the Squad, for example, are maligned on a daily basis, that have deeply misogynistic, racist in their nature, in order to make those threads go viral enough to undermine and require them to respond, that gets them really off of the agenda that they would like to be talking about. And this is what makes it so difficult for women to counter this kind of disinformation, because we don't control the way in which it can be easily weaponized. And that's largely because of the business model that is the engine of this. Engagement metrics that emphasize fear and conspiracy theories and things that are algorithmically designed in which to make these attacks go viral, to the point where we are where we are in the world, where you can imagine how this system at work is so dangerous for the future participation of women, which is already woefully inadequate in the US and all around the world.
All over the world, in the US and internationally, very often we see almost a playbook really being used. One of the most common disinformative narratives are around women's sexuality, with fake nude photos of women being spread, either entirely photoshopped or pictures simply of, you know, women that are not the women in politics that are targeted, with fake narratives. And so we have seen this at play with the Green Party candidate to chancellor in Germany in the latest elections, Annalena Baerbock. We saw a fake photo of a woman that was naked being spread online with a tagline saying that this was in fact the Green Party candidate, that she had been potentially a sex worker, and this was false. The woman in the picture was just not her. However, it was pervasive enough, this narrative, to in fact change entirely the course of her candidature, the course of her campaign. She ended up losing over 30 points in just a few months and arriving third in the elections after she had started as a front runner. This is a very similar narrative and similar playbook, in fact, that was used against Senator Laura Boldrini in Italy. There was a picture of a woman scantily dress. It wasn't her, but it was referred as her online, picked up then also by traditional media. And again, that was enough for many people to believe that it had been her, even after it was disproved. It happened a very similar thing to a member of parliament in Iraq, and it was enough really to get so much hate against her that her life was threatened. She ended up having to leave the country. So this is just one of the examples of a disinformative narrative that's deeply gendered.
You talked a bit about the role of technology. You mentioned Photoshop as one of the tools that are weaponized to create fake images, perpetuating women in certain scenarios that they did not take part of. Do you foresee gender disinformation campaigns against women getting worse as technology like deep fakes and artificial intelligence continues to develop?
Absolutely. When we talk about deepfakes, we have to remember that 96% of existing deepfakes feature women in acts of non-consensual pornography. So this reality is already there. It's already there for women in politics, it's already there for women leaders. And what we are seeing is that, in fact, young women all over the world are already considering social media as one of the main disincentives for considering a political career or even considering leadership options because they are scared of what could happen to them online. They are scared of what could happen to their pictures. So we see that young girls that just a few years ago, for the first time in history, were looking at a very broad set of options for them and for their futures. We see them reporting a need and a wish to actually scale back for fear of social media. According to some studies, social media is even the number one disincentive to considering a political career. So the consequences are really dire.
Touching on social media, in your research, you often describe social media as a double-edged sword, that women politicians often generate more engagement on their posts than their male counterparts. However, on the flip side, women are more likely to be targets of online abuse. And this effect is especially amplified if the woman identifies as a part of a minority group. Can you elaborate on this social media paradox and talk about how it impacts female leaders who belong to minority groups?
What we see from evidence in the United States and the UK is that women political leaders from minority groups are overwhelmingly targeted with hate, abuse, and disinformative narratives. I think we need a lot more research to really understand how this ultimately plays out and how this impacts really how engagement for women in politics works. The studies, mentioned in the report are very few, unfortunately, because this is, again, a field that is still heavily understudied. So I wouldn't want to generalize in terms of types of engagement that work for women in politics online. I think that we need just a lot more studies.
Let me add to that. Here's one of the problems that this issue intersects with, which is a poor understanding as a baseline of how is it that running for office is different for men than it is for women, and leading once in office is different for men than it is for women. And what I mean by that is that there is, in fact, a typology of the kinds of attacks that are part of the gender disinformation playbook that intersect with gender bias. So that takes the form of women having to prove higher standards of qualifications for being able to run to begin with, or appearance-based attacks. So no matter what level of office women in politics are subjected to, much more undue criticism of their appearance and voice and clothing. So those are memes and threads and strategies that get exploited. There's also higher standards of likability. And what we know throughout history, at least in the US, the data has shown us, is that while voters are willing to vote for men that they think are qualified but they don't like, they will not afford the same support to women. So that likability factor, which is hard to quantify, but certainly the internet piles on in trying to really characterize how women are either mean or untrustworthy or nobody wants to, be their friend. I mean, however ridiculous it may be, these are the kinds of things that get exploited and meet that kind of soft underbelly of society that still is pretty biased around women. So those are the kinds of threats that we think should be looked more seriously at. And it's why the platforms are largely missing the mark, because they are approaching this issue as if it's individual attacks by individual men, which it is in some cases, but that's not the problem that makes it gender disinformation. What makes it gender disinformation is that all of these types of attacks are weaponized in order to undermine women. And the most recent example from the German election is that Anna Baerbock, who was the front runner, was attacked really in lots of these ways around qualifications and whether she finished her exams in the proper way and all sorts of things that were exploded. And there was five times more disinformation that was coming from Russia Russian sources aimed at her than her male counterparts. Now, as the Green Party candidate who would have had a different relationship around energy and taken Germany perhaps in a different way, that might have been a consideration with now what we're looking at in Ukraine and how things are transpiring. So there's a long game that authoritarian actors in this space are playing, and they're using gender as a tactic to achieve, you know, larger goals in sort of realigning the world order, I would say.
Christina, you touched a little on there about the role of social media platforms in perpetuating this problem of likability and gender disinformation. What can we do about social media platforms, and what can we do about this issue?
Well, this is part of it. We have to get smarter about how these systems are working. And then for those who are deeply already engaged in the platform and tech accountability space, need to be less biased, I think, in their own recognition of this as an issue of equal importance as COVID and health misinformation, or as information driving climate change, because there's an intersection that relates to gender and women in almost all issues. In fact, our anecdotal research has really shown that there is more a likelihood of attack for women who are leading in the space of climate change and migration and immigration issues. And of course, if they talk about feminism, then they have a higher chance of being attacked online. So there are other policy agendas at work that get undermined by attacking women. And that's part of trying to create a silencing of some of the best leaders in this space, which I would argue some of the strongest and most effective pro-democracy movements around the world, in the U.S. too, are led by women, whether that's how Black Lives Matter came about, or it's the Belarusian women who have tried to overthrow the dictator in Belarus. It's Brazilian activists, a city council member who was, you know, murdered, and even after her death, gender disinformation was organized in order to continue to undermine what she was trying to do in opposing a so-called strongman leader there. So the first starting point is that we need to really better appreciate and understand this system at work. But then we really need to even further scrutinize and question the effect that this business model is having with online hate, extremism, and targeting of women leaders by the tools that are provided by digital platforms and that are made profitable, especially when ads are showing up on misogynistic content. That means Google, if it's YouTube, Facebook, Meta, if it's their platform, that they are financially benefiting from this kind of system. So the business model has to fundamentally change. There are reform efforts in the EU and UK, Canada and the US and Australia that will continue to be seeded. But I see it as one of the most urgent issues that is compromising our ability to have fair and free elections, to encourage women and girls to participate equally in society, and to prevent the atrocities that we're seeing unfold now in a country like Ukraine, brought forward by years and years of pro-Russian disinformation that was allowed to flourish on these platforms. So we have some serious questions to be asking ourselves as a society about whether we're going to finally speak to these harms, pass legislation, have some ability to leverage impact here, or whether we're going to just let trillion-dollar companies rule the world and buddy up with their authoritarian cohorts in other parts of the world.
And I think that there are two dimensions to add to this. So on the one hand is the idea that this is just the way the world works and has always worked. What we hear oftentimes social media companies say is that they did not invent misogyny. This was going on all the time, and there is therefore nothing that they can do about it. And this is wrong because, as Christina explained, this isn't so much about the misogynist next door sending, you know, a horrible tweet, which is, of course, a problem. But the problem we're talking about here, particularly with gender disinformation, is actually very different. We're talking about the coordination. We're talking about how easy it has become and how cheap it has become. Often for authoritarian leaders or a liberal movement to organize and to amplify their efforts through social media. And this is really taking advantage of a design of how social media works that's there and that companies are perfectly aware of. And they've been allowing for this to happen for many years. So the first thing is like to debunk the idea that this is just about misogyny. The second thing is to debunk another concept that social media companies have been happy to play on, which is that any type of standard or policy or regulation conflicts with freedom of speech. The reality is that today there is no freedom of speech for the millions of women that are being doxxed, attacked, that are seeing themselves being defamed online. There is nothing that they can do about it. And more women are reporting self-censoring. So there is widespread impact that this is having, not only on the lives of women that are targeted, but on our democracy at large, on our public discourse at large. And that's the part that we need to be very clear about and that we really need to address in a very different way than if we were just talking about the misogynist next door. This isn't about that. And social media companies know that very well. And this is just not an argument that's useful for them. There is one more thing that I think is worthwhile to mention here. And it is that what we are asking in terms of norms and standards and regulations for social media companies is nothing extraordinary or new. Like Professor Marianne Franks often say, we are not asking to hold social media companies to a higher standard than any other industry. When you are trying to build a bridge or, actually an addition on your house, there will be a system that will check to make sure that whatever you're doing is not harmful, that people will not get killed by the product that you are designing or by whatever you are building. This is something that we're doing for the food that lands on our table. It's something that we're doing for the bridges that our cars drive on and pretty much for everything in our lives. We have, however, allowed social media companies to really run wild. As they like to say, I think it was actually an old Facebook motto, to go fast and break things. They have broken a fair amount of things in the meantime, and that's just absolutely not acceptable. They need to be held accountable to the same duty of care that we have been asking every other industry to comply with. We need greater transparency and we need greater accountability, and we need it really now.
Let me give one example of how extensive this broken system goes. There was a lot of effort by Ukrainian civil society organizations. Many men and women are involved in this. And it has been an important function over the last couple of weeks to really showcase the way that Russian propaganda is endangering lives and justifying the invasion of a free and sovereign country. And one of the researchers who had been in, well, several actually we heard of, who have been public taking this huge risk at this moment to put this information out to the world, they were then blocked from Twitter because there was a Russian bot campaign and it was possible to do. And often the platforms, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, will come back and say, well, these are the things that you can do to protect yourself online. And here's our security toolkit. But what they aren't doing is protecting people online from the rest of what is propagated throughout their platforms and the way that bad actors are able to quickly game the system or just take advantages of the existing gaps in their terms of service and their lack of fundamental oversight. I just can't express how serious I think this system is underneath it and how disingenuous the platforms are in actually addressing it in a meaningful way.
Thank you so much for such an informative insight into this understudied field of gender disinformation.
You are listening to The Looking Glass, the audio complement to our print journal, The Sice Review. You can read our latest print edition on Project Muse. Thank you, as always, to the Foreign Policy Institute and our editorial board. This episode was produced by me, Jen Roberts. Music was produced by Simon Hudis. Thank you to our listeners, and we'll see you next time on The Looking Glass.